All right, folks, this is another episode of the Lane 8 BMX podcast. And this is a treat for me. Being a young man that raced BMX, I started when I was 13 in Minnesota, 14 years old. I knew of Tracer Finn. I followed him. I looked at the pictures. And of course, I'm not going to lie to you. I wanted to ride for CW. Of course, that never happened, but luckily I have the Hall of Famer. I have, I would say, a legend in BMX, but also in the state of Nevada, I would think, considered one of the, probably one of the fastest guys to ever come out of that state, even with Connor Fields. So I want to say, Tracer Finn, thank you for coming on the Lane 8 BMX podcast. It's a pleasure.
Psyched. Thanks. I appreciate it, Don.
You got it. Okay. Here's what I want. I like to, for me, I don't know if you've listened to some of my episodes, but I like to start at the beginning to move forward, to understand your journey in BMX and in life. So I think my first question to you, or my statement, is this: you started around 1975, 76.
Yes.
Your first number to you was 480.
Absolutely proud. Yes.
Tell me this. How did you get into BMX with your brother, Mike? And was it a passion of yours from the beginning?
Well, actually, yes. Even what Billy Griggs said in his is we were just wanted to be Evel Knievel, you know, and we had our bikes, and I'm from San Diego. I grew up literally riding distance from Rancho. Didn't even know it at the time, but we would jump everything and just blow ourselves up. Danger was the key. Danger was the motivation. And when I ended up moving to Vegas, I had a little YZ80, and the people that ran the motocross track ran the BMX track. So I went out to race motorcycles, and my parents said no, because I showed up with a application and, you know, made it for real.
Yeah.
And the family, the Williams family, started the BMX project here that went along with their motorcycle races. So I'd be out there anyway. And I ended up just sort of defaulting into it, because we would just ride home after the motorcycle races. I'd go watch and throw tires and help, you know, groom the track. And we'd ride all the way down the strip, all the way home. Now you wouldn't let your kid do that, but we really tore it up. And that was my first start, was going from motorcycles to bicycles. And the bike track was just rudimentary fun. Every element of BMX was there. Jumping, they had jumping contest, wheelie contest, two guys on the same bike, side-by-side race, uphill race. We'd race the track backwards. Slow races. We even had slow races where you get your balance. So we sort of captured every aspect of BMX. Yeah. And that's how I got hooked, was locally with the friends that I met at the track.
I remember, for me growing up in Minnesota, around 83, 84, I would always ride the streets with a group of friends and just hit the curb cuts doing jumps. And so, did you do anything like that?
Oh yeah, we were nuts. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if you know this, but a transplant from Vegas that was one of our original top five guys, and we sort of pushed each other, was Steve Rettelsberger.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know who that is. Yes, I do.
we shared, their parents would take me to the California races. So he was in Vegas, and him and I both sort of had a thing for it. He was a little older.
Yeah.
And he would put on a 48-16 in practice, and we would go riding from the side, one side of the town to the other. And he was one of the guys that pushed me. And then he moved away and then he turned pro, but he was from our system. You know, he would race in short pants out in the middle of the desert. You know, all we had was a buckled helmet, tank top, short pants, and it was 110 outside. So that was sort of where Steve and I, the connection from the Rettelsbergers, were from.
You were known for something that I was known for as a kid, and I find this really cool. You used to race in jeans, and I would race in jeans before I got my leathers. Talk to me about that. That's so funny.
Oh, well, it was just a hobby. You know, it was really just a hobby, and we had no idea that it'd be this cool, you know, long term. So I was running around making friends. It was better than school to me. It was better than high school. It was better than, you know, the friendships that I have today. 9 out of 10 are guys I lined up with or raced against or tried to date their sister. You know, it was just all the stories along with it. But racing in jeans was, that's all we had. And, yep. And I was tall, and my pants, even if I could find a pair of leathers, they were motorcycle pants, and they were cut up high for boots, and they were just floods. I mean, they wouldn't even cover my tube socks. And so I raced in leather in Levi's, and I was sponsored by my dad. So we really didn't have a kit.
Yeah.
So I started getting, you know, all the way through, I was just Levi's and a Mickey Finn Show jersey. And then I started making mains, and it cost me a lot of pictures. I've learned in hindsight, because I did look like such a hacker, you know, but then again, it looked so odd with, you know, you're racing against guys with like Polson and Eddie King and Medlin and Miranda, and you know, you're lining up with Pint, had a great kit, and I'm in a main with looking like a joker. And it wasn't on purpose. It was just, I didn't really want to ride for a bike shop. I always rode for my dad, because he paid my entry fees. So that was my sponsor.
Yeah. Nice. Nice. But I always thought it was cool, because I would beat some of the guys that were on the good bike shop teams in Minnesota, and I would beat them in jeans, and they would be all dressed up in all the kit. And you'd see them go to the pit, and all of a sudden you're seeing the team manager just going nuts. What are you doing?
So, yeah. What's that joker? And a good pair of jeans. They look good in school. If you could get a good pair of jeans going, they fit good with racing. No knee pads. Now I've had both knees replaced, and I go, maybe I should have upgraded my safety gear in the past.
Tell me this. What was the racing like back then, 75, 76, going into the 80s in Nevada? Was it a big scene? Because I know you had Desert Surf, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
You had Williams Raceway. How many tracks were there back then? Was there a large number of racers in Nevada at that time?
That's interesting, because somebody, I love this social media in a positive sense of people firing out old pictures. And we had over 1,000 riders.
Wow.
In our independent organization at Williams before we all jumped into MBA and then ABA.
Yep.
And we didn't really, I guess the outside world, maybe they tour through Vegas, but there was over 1,000 riders signed up. You know, I mean, we'd have, we raced age times weight. So yeah. It was just, if you were 12 years old and 98 pounds, you raced in lightweight. And if you're 13 and 98, you raced in middleweight. Or, you know, young guys would race big guys and old guys would race small guys. It was an interesting setup. But there was, before MBA came into town, that was our big deal, was Williams. And then we were hillbillies in a sense. And I say that proudly, because I just went to Supercross with the family that started BMX. I went to A1 with that group.
Yeah.
And we're still laughing and joking and locking each other out of hotel rooms and, you know, making fun of it. But it was a good place to start, but yeah. We were rubber band start. So we didn't really get, it was really tough to progress, because it was truly motocross. We didn't really have a starting gate until Desert Surf came along. And then we were all, a lot of us were a little slower out of those gates, because we didn't have a system before that. We were rubber band start,
yeah.
Doing it for fun, you know, and it took us a while to catch up.
How about the tracks back then? Were they, I would think that it would be mostly pedal.
Oh, mostly pedal, foot out, flat start. And the big deal was all the sand and caliche, because you would go, and it was definitely terrain. It wasn't like you were, there was fast tracks, but yeah. We had within the one association, we had a downhill track and then we had a regular track and we'd switch back and forth depending on wind condition. Yeah. Sometimes we race the track backwards because it was 30 mile an hour winds and it was easier to go uphill than it was to go down. It was sort of funny, but I don't think they could ever do that now. But it was rocky, hot, blazing hot, like 110, 115, no snack bar, nothing really. It wasn't like, oh, poor me. It was just a challenge. You know, you come out and you'd be hot, sunburned, tired, and do your best. It was motocross. It was definitely motocross. And we all had to evolve into the smoother, better courses like California. Once we got Desert Surf, we sort of had a controlled environment and they put a gate around the track so everybody wouldn't ride their ATVs on it and blow out all the corners. Yeah. So that was it. Definitely motocross.
I read that you were actually a big fan of downhill tracks.
Huge, huge. Yeah, wow. I wasn't a big guy. I wasn't strong. Let's put it that way. I wasn't going to overpower anybody. And once I found that I can, once I get going, I could spin. So once we would go the first ever race, I think maybe the first or second race we raced was out of town. We'd just say, hey, we're going to California. We had no info. I think I had a 4216 or something. I don't even know what I had on my bike. And we raced Wiener Mountain, which was probably one of the gnarliest downhills ever.
Yeah.
And we didn't have gears. We had brakes enough to pass inspection. So once I got that in my system, I started licking my chops and knew that there was other places for me to excel with those downhills. Cause I could get going and beat maybe a power rider that I normally would never be able to touch. Cause I could stay in the power zone and really, really get cranking. And I wasn't scared of anything because I came from motorcycles and I wouldn't, if there was a big jump or there was, you had to slow down. I came off of going twice as fast on my motorcycle. So I really excelled at the downhill tracks.
So would you say that you were more of a, correct me if I'm wrong, would you say you're more at that time, more of a skill rider? Because I'm thinking from that motocross, giving you that opportunity to actually overcome your fear, to face your fear and take those big jumps and then going to different tracks from like Vegas to California, you quickly learned how to use your skill to your advantage.
Yeah. You know, if you talk to all my friends, you'll never hear anyone say, oh, Tracer. Oh, he was smooth. It was hold on tight, pedal over everything. One of my nicknames was Gumby. And I think Billy Griggs gave me that because I'd look just like a rubber band on my bike. I just pedaled and never quit pedaling. I guess skill would mean just flat out, you know, like I could get going fast and I didn't, boy, I did look up to the skill riders and try and learn like Richie Anderson. I'd study how he pedaled.
Yeah.
And I think that really got me into making those 16 and over expert mains that were, every one of those guys or many of them went on to top pros. But to get to those mains, staying in fourth in a semi and not blowing up and getting in the pack, I was comfortable. So I would say my skill level, and it's gone down every year since, but, it definitely didn't mind going fast. That was my thing.
By the time you were 17, I read you were NBA national number two,
mm-hmm.
and you were Nevada number one. But here's my question to you. Were you Nevada number one multiple years?
Yes. About two and a half in a row. NBA started tailoring off, and ABA was really, I don't want to say the place to be, but that was where the fast guys were going.
Yeah.
So I was such a regional rider with, I don't want to say no support, but anywhere I could get in my mini truck, I would go race. I'd take off and race after every weekend after school. I would leave on Friday, come back Sunday night. And that was where I was chasing points. And the ABA was a national circuit. And I was just working at a gas station in a bike shop and sponsored by my dad. And yeah, we weren't going to be able to fly anywhere. So I was definitely one of those regional racers. Like I'd say local hero kind of goals, you know, the time until I started getting support, which was CW.
It was CW.
We'll be right back.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
When you started going nationally, was it a big, or even just regionally, was it a big step up for you? You know, it's one thing to race in Nevada and you're the hot shoe. It's another thing when you're facing guys, you know, that are just as fast or better. Was it a big transition for you to race those guys?
That's a great question, because I would say opening a new door.
Yeah.
Because I was able to race. I think I raced every world champion in our class locally, or at least at regional nationals. So I was comfortable with those guys. But you would go to, once I started traveling, you go to a local town and everybody was, all it was everybody was like us. We all had the local hot shoe. You go into I want to be funny about this, is I think I raced a guy in overalls once that kicked my butt.
Wow.
You know, like we raced, and I'm joking about that, but you would go anywhere in the country and there is somebody, you better not point at that moto sheet and say, I got this.
Yeah.
Because I had a guy that I grew up with racing that was sort of a take you out kind of guy. And he was really fast, and he was braggadocious about how I'm going to kick your guy's butt. And then he'd say things to you. He had the mind game down, but it was a negative one. Yeah. And I said, man, if I ever get fast, I'm not going to be like that. So you go to a local town and that local guy wipes you off the track. You know, you just have to know that you better get back to work and figure out what you need to do to beat him. So the nationals actually were better for me because it was a bigger stage. Yeah. I dug it. I love the crowds. And to get to the main, a lot of guys were so fast that in that class, I was okay in third and fourth. Like I had no negativity making a main event all the way through and like being that last guy in the semis. There was always, you know, I lined up with Medlin and Eddie King and Polson, that odds of me beating them in the first corner, minimal, but I could slide in there and get to a main event. Then there'd be three fast guys lined up. They'd all go in and charge each other. And that might be my opportunity to get in there, because none of them are laying off. I never had if I had a steep gate, I could get out with them, but it wasn't intimidating. It was actually quite fun because I felt like I could go further the bigger the race was.
Wow. You had very good pack riding skills.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was a fourth place guy, even in a semi. I took it.
I'm curious, back then when you're just starting to get into the 80s and stuff like that, and you're getting older, did you do any training? I'm obviously it's not like it is today where young guys are training like very young. But was your training mostly on the track, or were you riding the streets like I was? Because I couldn't get to a track all the time.
Riding the streets was huge. We would ride to the strip, which at the time you could ride up and down the strip, and we get a pack of 15 or 20 of us, and we'd ride down the strip, and we were putting in the miles. We'd raise our seat a little bit. So I guess that's how, like, the cool down seats, you know, that was our, we got away with that, I guess, early. And we would jump in the fountains and grab change. And then that was our lunch money. And so
I love it.
We really pushed it. And then when I did get enough where I could see if I needed to train a little bit, I had built an old starting gate, like a wooden starting gate on the side of the house from a drum riser from my dad's show. So it was perfect. A drum riser, two doors, axe handle, and a gate with hinges. And that was our starting gate. And I'd take off on the side of the house and go between the house and the fence around the pool, then jump. We had a little mini half basketball court. We would sort of have a little circle around it, and then jump back out, and we would do little sprints. Unlike Billy Griggs' backyard track, it wasn't that, but it was definitely time where I had to put in the work, because these guys, you could have gone either way. Yeah, that fourth place, one place back, and you're not making it. So I had to stay there and make some of those mains and learn how to really get, once I got bigger, I got faster and got more comfortable with the guys.
Not bad. Okay. You touched on something that I do want to ask you. So it's going to go a little bit away from BMX, but it's just the fact of growing up in Vegas, because Vegas is back then is not what it was, what it is now. And so you can give me an idea of what it was like to ride a bike and grow up in Vegas during that time. I'm curious.
Yeah. When I was a kid, my brother, we would live in the hotels before we moved here full time. So we would come in and say the Landmark Hotel. My dad would be staying in the suites up top. So we'd stay all summer here before I even moved here full time in 75. Wow. And we would leave our BMX bikes in valet, and we'd swim, and we'd play in the arcades in the hotel. We lived in the hotels for 3 months at a time, and we go out and grab our bikes out of valet and then ride around and put our bikes back. And people say, did you live in hotels? And I say, absolutely. We would stay in the hotels until we moved here permanently.
Yeah.
And it was so fun living here. There was a ton of racing scene, ton of racers, really good people, good families, which everybody, you know, we all look back and say the best part about it was our parents and the people that really continued our friendships, where you weren't old enough to drive, so they would take you to a friend's house for a birthday, or you say, hey, I'm leaving the races with this guy and their family for 3 days. Nobody would even blink twice. But this town was pretty safe. And it was really fun. You could ride all night down the strip. And once, I think it was about 1 a.m. was curfew. And I actually have a story. Steve Reynoldsberger and I got pulled over by the police riding to Lake Mead, because we left at 2 a.m. because we knew it'd take us at least like 16 hours total to get there and back. And we'd stay up all night and ride and run from police security. We definitely weren't getting into trouble, but I definitely say we were out a little farther later than we should be. So it was a good time. That's for sure. You could have got into trouble, but man, that bike was a safety net, like lifetime safety net. I just have to give it thanks. That's for sure.
Not bad. When did you get your first full-on race bike? Was that when you joined CW with Mike Miranda helping you get on the team, or did you have one before?
No, you know, I was a jumper. So all my bikes were based off not bending them. And I used to ride the Schwinn Comp. For some reason that fit me. I think I rode one from I was 12 to about 15.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have a race bike. I rode pretty much most people's, what they would call their jump bikes. So I had that. And then my first new frame I ever bought, and I saved all my money, was I bought an Anderson Avalanche. And like I said, I studied how he speed rolled, and I could get over our first jump here just without missing a beat and watching his technique. And so, but I turned that into my jump bike. Everything was my jump bike. You know, I'm one of those guys that wasn't, you'll never say, oh, Tracer, he was the best racer. I definitely got in the mix and might've won a few I shouldn't have and set myself up for success.
Yeah.
But man, did I love to show off and jump, and that was my thing. And I just stayed with it as long as I could.
From reading and listening to some podcasts on your history, I understand Mike Miranda was the guy that helped you get on CW. How was that? I'm curious, you know, everybody has that feeling where, you know, you get your first, somebody gives you something for racing or something like that. What was that feeling like when you got your first frame and fork and your first jersey? That had to blow your mind.
Yes. And so I'm going to say the first sponsored piece of gear was probably the goofiest. Was I was racing Corona, and I was pretty good at that track. I mean, I could hang, you know, I could podium in 16 expert, which wasn't easy. And I had met Mike before. We raced together, but he brought me into the sort of CW fold and introduced me to Roger and some of the other cats, Andy Zerzo.
Yep.
And that day he gave me my first ever piece of gear was a saber plate. You know,
yes, I do. I know what it is.
Yeah. So, excuse me. So, you know, everybody has great stories, like Jason talked about it, TNT and the parts and
yep.
things that you get. my stuff wasn't trick. It was a saber plate, which made my bike look like the Jetson mobile, you know, I ran that plate, and it started a relationship with CW. And then Mike actually would give me his old pants, and they were Floods. That's why I liked it when Gators came along. They were good for me. But
yeah.
My first pair of racing pants ever. The first pair of racing pants, I think I was almost 17X. I was midway through 16X was I didn't wear racing pants until Mike Miranda gave me an old pair of his. And then they gave me a little CW jersey, the team one. It wasn't factory. And I wore all my other red, white, and blue gear, which looked hokey, but got some pictures in magazines, and they sort of felt like I was a good beat player, I guess. A sideshow in Vegas terms. I was a good sideshow. I could, you know, I might get fourth or fifth or podium in the main, but then I think that very first race at Corona that he gave me the number plate, I got a full page jump in the water hole in BMX Plus. And it has the saber plate. And so a lot of guys were winning and a lot of guys were fast, but I seemed to draw a little more attention by being an idiot and not scared of landing hard and flat. That's for sure.
Wow.
So I have to thank Mike.
Okay. Then I've got to ask you, how did you meet Mike, and how did that relationship become what it was? And I would say what it is now still. How did you guys become such close friends?
Wow. There's a picture at Irvine where we're doing 360s and it got some coverage, and it turned into a sort of an iconic photo. They used it for the Vans 50th anniversary.
Yep.
And I was actually the first time they put it in the book, I was unidentified because I was Levi's t-shirt and I borrowed a helmet. Somebody said they won't get you in a magazine unless you wear a helmet. And I was like, well, we don't jump with helmets at home. You know, I wasn't jumping to get in a magazine. I was jumping because there was 50 people saying, you know, going like this. So
yes,
I would have to say I love the crowd pleasing aspects. To say that would be an understatement. I loved it. So I was jumping in it. Mike Miranda is in the picture watching. He could see it was number 27 riding his SE quad angle. And I remember now that we're such great friends, I look back and I go, there's Mike's arm. You know how you can look at an old BMX picture and say, oh, that's so-and-so's dad.
Yep.
That's my truck, or that's, you know, so he just was always kind to me. Like nobody really had much ego, but he was always cool to me. And once he got me on the flow team, he says, hey, I can help you out.
Yeah.
I believed him because I sort of knew him as a competitor. And then that just blossomed once I started integrating with the team and traveling as Vegas is on the way to most places back east. So when they go to the Grands or go to Texas or they anytime Salt Lake was my first national with them because they came through Vegas and built my bike in a van on the way to the track. So being in Vegas was a good spot because everybody liked Vegas, and Mike's relationship was really healthy because he told Roger, you want this guy on your team. You know, he didn't see me as a threat like Pistol Pete, or, you know, I wasn't the man. You didn't want me on team sheets, but you might, if you wanted a picture in a magazine, it might be worth putting a logo on me. So Mike believed in me because he thought I have never asked him why, but I would probably think he thought I was rad, you know, and that was the era. That's all I cared about, you know, trophies are trophies, but you get up there and have those experiences of flying and people just thinking it's nuts. That's what I really enjoyed.
Not bad. What was that? I'm glad you said something about getting up there and flying because you were known as a jumper. What was that feeling of being weightless and just, you had so much style? I saw a picture where you were just crossed up and I just thought it was so rad. I was looking at it before we came on and it's just, you had so much style on the bike. Was that just something natural or just, it just came after a while of just repetitively jumping?
Well, nobody's ever asked me that specifically, but I would say it's because I had time to. You know, most when you're racing, everybody's sort of tucking and, you know, that, like, you know, guys are, but when I was jumping, I would just pedal as fast as I could go and bunny hop and just get that extra, whatever. I learned later with the guys at X Games of what you could do with how much time you had in the air was divided by what you could do.
Yeah.
And when I would get up there, if I had enough time, I could set myself up and I wasn't afraid of pulling out of it. So the safety zone, I guess, of normal style is you get up, you do your thing, you land safe and you live to tell about it, you know, and I had no problem crashing my brains out. I had no problem with it. Like if I could get something that hadn't been done, or if I could get far enough where it looked rad, your friends know. You know, it's like, okay, you just go up and go, okay, that's style. But your friends, and it mostly from friendships, is guys pushing you, is that once we're trying to up each other, and if you could get somewhere where no one else would go, that was a goal. you know, is that guy's not going to do it. He has a brand new bike. He has Z rims, or he has SOA. You know, the next guy might not be able to, because maybe they don't have insurance for the hard crash that they're going to take. And I just wasn't afraid. I look back and it's, I don't know if it's a good or bad thing, but it didn't scare me I wish I could do those big air and pull in runs, you know, like that would have been to me exhilarating. And I just went as fast as I could on my bike and got as high as I could. And it gave me extra time to throw something.
Yes, sir. I saw a picture and boy, this would have blown me away. I saw a picture of, I don't know if it was your mom or your dad who took the picture, but it was outside your house and it was a van and then the CW, what do you call it? It's like the storage unit that you guys were putting everything in. And it was the first time that they had come to pick you up to go to a race. Okay, I'm curious if you remember walking out of your house or even just looking out the window and seeing that. What went through your mind? Because I would have been blown, man.
Oh, you saying that, as you were explaining it, I pictured everything about it. It was enough of a moment where my family, who's arguably rock stars,
yes,
went out and took a picture because something I was doing was so cool. It was so,
yes,
like, and it wasn't like, oh, I made it, because back then there wasn't I made it. We didn't know the levels, you know, there wasn't levels then, I guess. But when everybody jumped out of the van, it was, you know, Billy and the Tosh Moravyov and the group and Zerzos and their family. It was like joining a band, you know, and then they came to, they picked
That's
me up.
A pretty
up,
good like, explanation.
We're picking up the new bass player, you know, and them pulling up and then including me, because I don't want to say I looked up to the factory riders because they were mostly my friends and I wasn't on that program, but everybody was pretty good to me. But all of a sudden joining the band, that made me happy. It was a whole new experience. And man, it's made me a better man than I am today. Cause those stories with those cats are immeasurable. Wow. So cool. that was exciting when they pulled up, and I felt like I was, you almost, this is funny. I watched this movie, The Almost Famous.
Yeah.
I almost say that I was almost famous. It was so fun. I'm like, I'm getting to go with this rock star team. And that was a rental van with it's like a 14 passenger van with all our bikes in a trailer. And it was pretty, look at my cheeks right now. It meant that much to me. It was good because they let me in their group.
That's cool. Okay, with joining that team, did your racing, in the sense of the races that you hit and where you hit them, ramp up? Did you travel much to the East Coast because you were on CW? Where did that team take you?
Wow. You know what it did? It took me to places I've never been before, because like I said, I was so regional.
Yeah.
And going back East was such a great experience. I loved the tracks. I loved the camping, the family atmosphere. You go and sit on the grass, like in Tennessee or Memphis, you know, just you're sitting there and you're meeting everybody, their family, their, you know, I don't think any of us ever brought money to the races. You know, somebody's feeding us. I thought it was great because they took me to places I'd never been. I think the first place we raced was, they flew us to Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And I'd never been that far for a bike race. You know, I traveled with my parents, seen the country with their shows.
Yeah.
But I tell you, go in there and it be about you and about your performance and somebody I really respected, somebody giving a heck about me as part of their team and their family. So, boy, that completely extended my range, found out how fast everybody was across the country.
Yes, sir.
Got to go to world championships that were, I wouldn't have been able to before. So that was a huge treat, and getting to be a part of that was pretty awesome.
Did it open your mind to other people and places? Did it mature you as a young man?
Oh, absolutely. I kid that I'd come home on a Monday or maybe Tuesday if I didn't get a flight. And my friends would say, how was your weekend? And I go, in Michigan, we went water skiing with the Edwards family in their backyard. We stayed in a basement. I'd never seen a basement before, coming from California. And I got to do things that I'd never done before and meet new people. And I'd come back from school, tell my stories. And then my friends, I say, what did you do? And they said, well, we got really drunk and we wrecked my mom's car. And I go, oh, okay. Glad I missed that. Yeah. It definitely made me experience some things I never would have been able to do. And now I actually have so many friends. Like, I have to turn my phone off sometimes because I work so early that people start calling at 7 a.m. back east. Hey, how you doing? They check on you. Friendships, the Florida crew, the people that I met, a lot in Michigan, a lot of friends for life.
Yeah.
And I would have never made those friendships that we made back then. That was pretty cool. And those tracks, I mean, it was huge. I mean, those big races were, when ESPN started with that stuff, it was Olympic style. That's okay. For sure.
How many races would you say in, let's say, the heyday of racing CW, how many races would you hit nationally? And were you the type of guy that would actually still race even though you were factory? Because nowadays, some people I interview, they'll say, I only race nationally. I don't race locally unless I have to, for grands, for The Rock. But did you go back home and race, period?
Yes. That's a really good point about what people can learn about racing locally. I'll stop right now and brag about our track operators here. There's four tracks. One of them is run by one of the best dudes ever, Turnell Henry.
Yep.
He runs one of our tracks. Then there's Makiva Hobson's family that completely are involved. We have Tay Wilborn, a racer that runs Boulder City, and then Joe Dotson, who runs Nellis, which all Nellis and Ed Fountain Park, 82 and 84 respectively. There was a lot of work to do locally for me as a rider. We had a pro here and we would race Wednesday night pro-ams for $20 and a pizza. And I see what you're saying about racing locally, because it was tough because I couldn't get third. You know what I mean? Like, I couldn't go out and just have a fun night. And if I didn't have a great gate, you pinch people off and you ride aggressive when you get to the semis at a national, you close the door, you do that. But if a guy's got you locally, you don't need to pimp anybody, or the guy has to work the next day. So it was tough to race locally, but I enjoyed it because everybody threw their best. I think I had a guy one time pay for a kid to race the cruiser class just to wear me out. It was funny because he told me he did it. And it was a dad that said, I'm, like a 16X kid and I'm running vet pro at, 35. And it's sort of funny that comes out, but There's a guy named Mark Thrower that was a pro, probably one of the fastest guys I've ever raced in my whole life.
O'Neill, didn't he, or something like that? O'Neill.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was one of the first GT riders too. The GT long was welded for him because he was so tall. And he was so fast, and he was probably 3 years older than me. I weighed 145, and he was probably 190 and a pro 190. Like he was fast. So I always had a carrot to chase. We'd race 10 times. I might beat him 7. And those 3 I cherished, you know, he would beat me 7 out of 10 times. And the 3 I got, I'd appreciate because he was tough to beat.
Yeah.
And if you could pull him on the first straightaway, you know, your training and your efforts were doing good. So I actually had a ringer here locally that kept me tip top. That's for sure.
Not bad.
So I enjoyed the local scene, really enjoyed it.
How did you handle, again, I'll go back to this again. It's one thing to be fast where you're from, but then going nationally, there is, most people will admit that there is a bit of pressure that you face because now you're factory and many people get in their mind, it's all based on results. So I'm curious, Tracer, how did you handle that pressure?
Well, racing against the other guys and being a factory rider, I was mixing it up with the factory guys anyway. You know, I bet you most of my pictures, I would hope the guys know that I could have been a threat here and there, or at least be one that might take one of those semi spots to the main. So, I've never asked anybody if they respected me, but I would think that they had to know that I was going. My goal was to win. Yeah. And, you know, the pressure of being a factory rider, I felt my job was to sell bikes. And we had a top pro, and we had just a star-studded team. And I truly felt my job was to be me, which was, all right, I might bend this bike, but I'm hitting that jump, you know, I'm hitting the backside of that berm and crossing it up. Yeah. I mean, like anybody, I would have loved to have some more titles under my belt, but somebody paid me, sort of a top regional racer, I guess, to travel the world or the country and race and then show off and jump. And I feel like I still got mine, even though that there wasn't any pressure on me, because I know they didn't use me on team sheets, because I could get second in 17X, or I could be out in the semi. You know, I wasn't a dominant racer, so I had to pick my moves, make it happen. So the pressure on me was just to show up, do what I needed to do, enjoy myself, maybe get in a magazine, sniff out where the cool jump is, if there's a photo shoot going on, you know, maybe just, I always, my whole goal was to get the most out of it for my sponsor. So he kept sending me places to be. And, you know, what do they say? Kissing hands, but, you know, kissing babies and shaking hands. Right. You know, and Roger brought me into that fold of the bike industry and showed me how his other brands were working and how he was going starting to go to Taiwan and make other projects and products. Came on with RevCore and came on with Shadow Racing. So I sort of was more groomed on that side of it. But yeah. It, as far as the win goes, that was for Billy and for Pistol Pete and, you know, a lot of those Charlie later on, a lot of those guys were there for team sheets. I was there to be me.
I respect that. I'm curious of your bike at the time. What was your setup? And I always remember as a kid into an adulthood of those straight bars.
Mm-hmm.
What was your setup? What length of cranks were you riding? What size frame were you riding? And if you don't mind going from there.
Oh, that's interesting, because I don't want to say I was in that factory. I never asked for a custom frame.
Yeah.
Later on, I rode one of Billy Griggs' custom frames, and it was beautiful. I could, when he talks about going to Schwinn and not having the right bike geometry and stuff, it made a difference. That CW was probably a good bike for me. It would have been nice to have the bottom bracket a little farther back, but my first CW complete was the brass one. And it was the sexiest bike I ever had. It was so beautiful. That. Just was, red and brass. And I was so proud of my bike, and I kept my bike in my bedroom. Raise your hand out there. If you had your bike in your bedroom,
I did.
And you'd look at it before you go to sleep. And,
yep.
And I had it set up, but I rode the CW stock frames, and the handlebars I never really got used to because I would tuck and I would hit my chin on that crossbar. Okay. And I rode more on the front of my bike, and you know how guys ride and they're like a Daryl Young. I could say a name to you and you'll go, oh yeah, yeah, Charlie Williams, Daryl Young. They're powering out, the front end's going all around, even Eddie King. Like I was up on the bike. So when I had to tuck, those handlebars were right in my way.
Okay.
And so I would kick my bounce my Jofa up when I'd hit him. So whenever I would always start out with CW bars, and then I would go away from them. And I actually, James Vicente will like this. I like the Galindo bars and the GT bars with the, it just had a good bend and fit my hands perfect.
Yeah.
But the bike was set up good. It looked, I always had a lot of pride in it with it. And I loved having a factory bike. And then the coolest CW I ever rode was one that Billy Griggs had made, and he gave it to me. He had it custom made and already gone to Schwinn, and it was perfect for me.
So, I don't think Billy always gets, I hear a lot of people talk about his racing, but I don't think he gets enough recognition for his input in frame building and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I was a 17, 18 year old, and I'm riding a 15 year old's geometry that because he knows what's going on, you know, that was impressive. You know, I mean, but if you're there, you know that he did that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the magazines presented, like you said, the CW with twin stickers on it. But you know, I wish I would have, you know, you talked about bikes. I think I wish I would have raced cruiser when it came along, because I was long legged, and I think I might have had a little success with that, because I fit the cruisers better.
Yeah.
And I felt that those were trick bikes. I ended up with one, and Roger, we were somewhere, I think it was Funway. Where's Funway? Back east somewhere, maybe New Jersey. It was an arcade connected to a BMX track. It was really amazing, right next to a river. And somebody pro didn't show up, and Roger said, "Would you race pro cruiser?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "If you make the manual, I'll give you the bike."
Wow!
So it was a black CW bike, and I just said, "This is awesome!" And I made the main, and he gave me the bike. So I thought, "All right, now I have a cruiser." So I think I should have sniffed that cruiser out, because I was racing 16X and open, and the odds of making one or the other, you know, you might get one of them. So that seemed more sensible. Yeah. But I think racing three bikes, I don't know if I had the legs for it.
Yeah. Well, tell me this: when did you decide to go pro? And how was that decision made? And where did you make that decision?
Well, I raced 16 and over expert when it was just 16 and over expert. Like it was the cream of the crop. And the 14 and over open class, you know, some of my favorite races and favorite results might not have been a win. You know, you look down the line and you see who you're racing and you see their accomplishments, and I raced that 14 over open and 16 over expert. Then I raced 17 over expert and sort of ran that dry, I guess. And then they switched it to 18 and over expert. And again, I was the sideshow. And by then I was working in show business and making really like, making a living. And I just didn't want to keep now racing 18 over expert. And we had a top pro. I think when I turned pro, it might have been Pete. I don't know. I just Roger didn't think I'd be a good pro. Because by then I was working full time, and I didn't really have the commitment to be fast or to get that straight. So I just turned pro because I wanted to try it. You know, I wanted to be a pro once and call myself a professional. You know, I wasn't really peaking. I was just going, okay, I raced 16 over X, 17 over X, started 18 over X, and all the guys that I had raced along the way were all top pros. So I just figured, you know, I'd like to go after this and won a couple here or there, but be pro, I guess, made it so I could always come back and sign up and race and have a fun time.
Was the pro life what you thought it would be?
Well, for me, it was strange because I think, you know, people talk about money, and I think I made 20 times more working than I did winning pro purses, you know? So it wasn't a financial thing for racing pro for me. It was, by then I was working and I was just making sure I didn't get hurt. So my career for racing sort of ended about, you know, 17 expert, good amateur, turn pro to turn pro. Yeah. And I don't think I scared anybody, but I raced here and there.
When did you decide to just full on retire?
Well, I didn't, by the time I was 18 and a half, I was lighting director at the Golden Nugget downtown. Well, I was on the crew and became lighting director by the time I was 20, but I was doing big time shows, big career move. And I wasn't going that way for the racing salary. I wasn't going to make a living at racing, that's for sure. Yeah. And I got a lot out of it. I probably got a lot more out of it than I should have, because I was pretty much a regional, good regional guy.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't trade it for anything. But the whole racing full time, or at least going out, Roger always supported me. He said, anytime you want to race, come out. Matter of fact, I don't know if you know, when I hurt my hand racing.
Yeah.
That was the night after a Kenny Rogers show. They had the Nationals were in Vegas, so I just went out and raced it. And then, as you know, got my hand messed up pretty bad. And
it was a chain ring, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually a back wheel.
Back wheel.
So I got a guy. We used to have moto money where you just get paid for motos, and it was the Gold Cup Championships. We're in Vegas, so I thought, oh, I work and race. So I came into the first corner, and a guy center punched me, and his he never fell, but my bike went like this. You know, my wheel and my hand flew out like this, and you can see that's what happens when your hand goes out. So my hand went out and it went in his spokes. So it went around his wheel and up to his brakes, and the cross section of the spokes pinched it and then pulled it off. So it left the bone. So the bone was still there, but the finger was gone. I had those 09 wrapped gloves.
Yeah.
So my glove didn't fall off, but the finger was gone. And we just stopped and raced, and we couldn't find my finger. And I'm yelling at the turn official, get my finger. Well, I use a couple cuss words. So get my finger. And we couldn't find it. We're digging around. Everybody stopped. We're all looking around for my finger. I'm in shock. They called the moto back, And it was my buddy, Joe LaMarche, who I've known since I was raced with, since I was like 13, from NorCal. It was in his wheel. And then we grabbed it and then took off and tried to save it. And they couldn't, they works pretty good, see? But they couldn't save it. But when they taped it all up after surgery, I worked a spotlight the next night. They called me. Yeah, I went to work and I said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Hey, man, this kind of money, I'm not, you know, I'm not turning down a you know, good night pay." So that was sort of a, you know, sort of how my pro career was just, it wasn't really even a career. It was just, I'd love to race. I was probably a little faster than the amateur class, but not quite a double A, or definitely not a double A threat. So I'd come out and race that B pro whenever I could and maybe make the main. And back then it was three motos. So you get a fifth, a first and a third, and maybe end up second overall, or, you know, it was random starts. So it was a little tougher to get going.
Yeah.
But the career thing has just been, I still work for the same company that I started, that I left BMX for, you know.
Not bad.
And, but I never technically, heck, I just raced Frogtown, you know, so,
yeah.
So I don't say I ever quit racing. I just take it on a different level.
Do you have ghosting with the finger?
Yes. It's weird. When I'm asleep, I do. Or when you try and stretch your hands out. Cause when you're asleep, you go, "Oh, I have a hand cramp," and you don't wake up, turn on your light and go, "I have a hand cramp," and look at your hand, you know? So you're physically trying to move what's not there. And that's sort of trippy. But it's been I don't know, it got me a page in the magazine. I'm kidding, but it's been I think I was one of the first to get their fingers cut off racing. So I'll take it.
Does it hurt?
No, not at all.
Not at all?
Not at all. No.
Wow. That is crazy. Okay. So tell me this. I'm really interested in your career and your family business because, okay, so the family started in San Diego. They had a club. And was your mom and dad doing jazz in the club?
Yeah, ragtime, Dixieland, jazz, Roaring Twenties, really good stuff.
1960s to what, 1974?
Yeah, 50s through mid-70s. And then my dad, up until COVID, did shows.
Really?
So, yeah, he's amazing. Amazing piano player. Amazing.
Okay, so what I was reading was that your dad, you guys were doing so well in San Diego that you ended up having a show with NBC.
Yes.
Mickey Finn's.
They came down and saw my parents playing at a social gig and had heard about the buzz of the Mickey Finn show. My dad opened that nightclub when he was 21. And driven and talented. He's a virtuoso. And it got so big that that NBC made him an offer, and they ended up filming a series, sort of like, you know, Sonny and Cher, Happy Hour, you know, it was like the Variety Hour, Jack Parr kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they were rock stars, and our nightclub that my dad owned was off the hook. So we grew up in a blast of an environment. My brother and I just getting the most out of it, that's for sure. And NBC put them on the map, and that's why they started headlining Vegas, because they got big, real big.
I'm curious. Most people will never have that type of atmosphere, that type of, I would say, growing up in that type of atmosphere. Was it so? It obviously it was just kind of normal for you, because when we were talking before we decided to start taping, you're talking about some of the folks that you met. I mean, for you to say that you've met Sinatra, who in the hell can actually say that and sat down and talked to him?
Yeah. For what was interesting is I had an excellent perspective from my parents because they were absolute rock stars. And, you know, the Reagans were friends with my parents because he was governor of California. And all the astronauts, I'm a big astronaut buff, and they all had personal chairs set up because they would fly out of Miramar Air Force Base in San Diego, and all the jet fighters would come down and party at their nightclub. So they all became friends. Matter of fact, I have a banjo from Scott Carpenter, who was the first man to circumnavigate the globe. And I have his personal banjo that he gave my family. And they hung with those guys. They made the San Diego Charger cannon that they blow off at the games. My dad used to have a 60-foot fire truck that we grew up, you know, climbing all over, and had the steering wheel in back where the back end would drive around. We would hang out with Andy Williams. My dad was a good friend with Don Knotts, and there was always somebody famous, but they always treated us pretty good. When you're a kid, you don't know that's Jerry Lewis. We're having coffee with, you know, we would just say, can we get some more quarters for the arcade, you know? So we grew up around that. So then when I started my career, when I did star shows, it just was off the hook. I knew where to settle in.
Yeah.
Not be, I would give them good work with the shows and lighting, but also we all spent time. I spent my 21st birthday with like the production manager from Sinatra, and we were all friends. We'd come into town and hang out, and it was really a good time back then. That's for sure.
Okay. So mom and dad, mom would sing, dad would play piano. Were they just naturally gifted at what they've done, and then just use that natural talent to go from local to worldwide, really?
Yeah. You know, specifically my dad, this is a funny story. My dad started playing piano at the age of 6 because he got his finger cut off.
Wow.
So he put his finger in a mix masher, the mashed potato. He went to get a scoop and it cut his finger off, and they sewed it back on and said, it'll die if you don't exercise it. So my great aunt bought him a piano. And so he played piano and learned at that age. And he was such, you know, how like Michael Phelps, and it has the longer arms. So he's like a crazy swimmer. And if he didn't get into swimming, we would never have that guy. And my dad playing piano with the way that he thinks and puts out music. Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, if you see right above my head, these are all albums. I have 14 albums right there of albums that they did. And there's, back behind me is a book that he wrote.
Yep.
And then that right there is NBC. I think you can see the logo.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the promo of the family sitting on pianos.
And you put a mic on top of the piano and you sitting down right there on it. Yeah.
So it, you know, for what they've done, my dad was definitely the musician, and my mom was beautiful, and she learned to play banjo, and she would be the MC, the hostess kind of thing, and pushed that part of the business. So between the two of them, they made it skyrocket. And then after they got divorced, that's when I moved to Vegas full time, was with my dad. So it was up until we did the Vegas in 75, it was rock star mania. I mean, it was rock star before you know, rock star. You know, they were tearing it up. They had a good time.
So how did it come about with Vegas? I mean, it's one thing to have I would think that the TV show was the one that really gave them the jump off to go to Vegas.
Yeah. They opened a new place. You might have heard of it, called Caesar's Palace. And the first act in Caesar's Palace was Andy Williams. And the second act, headliner act, was my parents. So they, and that was when Vegas, if you headlined in Vegas, you were royalty.
Yes.
And we stayed in the hotel. We ate room service. I didn't think it was any different where you just say, I want a cheeseburger. So you pick up the phone and you order a cheeseburger. And we weren't brats. I don't think we were brats, my brother and I, but we certainly had an interesting childhood. But it was, they started in Vegas, you headlined Caesars.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. And so then my dad headlined in town for, wow, almost 30 years. So he's just a virtuoso piano player. And then my mom was the business side, and was a radio host. Actually, she worked for, she worked with Don Kirshner on cable television when it first started coming out. And you would know some of this, as she worked for, Today. They were grooming her for the Today Show.
Wow.
Yeah. She moved to Denver today. And then you might be interested in this because of your history is that she was on that route, but ended up going back to San Diego and doing radio shows for a year. So the entertainment lineages run strong in the family. I'm probably the only one that doesn't have the onstage chops, but I work backstage.
That's what I was going to ask you. So you went if you don't mind me saying it, correct me if I'm wrong, the technical route, than being in front of them, or standing there on stage. Did you know right away you were more inclined to doing the technical things than just being out front?
Absolutely, because when you're a kid, that's intimidating. Being on stage, commanding an audience, you know, you sort of have to learn to be in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And I would sit in the light booth because I was young, and the union guy would be smoking he won a smoke break, so he'd say, hey, run the spotlight. So I started running the spotlights, and
I love it.
They would say, hey, kid, come on. I was welcome because I wasn't going to take their job at 13. And then so when I got out on my own, my career took off quite well, because I had some chops. You know, I wasn't afraid. I'm comfortable with music, understood the business. And I didn't have any bad habits in Vegas, and that could be detrimental to many. And I'd already seen it all. So I was pretty lucky to be on this side of it. And it's, I'll be back at work setting up shows in the morning.
Damn. So I know you did Siegfried and Roy. You've done Circus du Soleil. Is it difficult to light those shows?
Boy, you know, I did star shows for about 8 years, which was great because I could just do it off the hip. I would watch rehearsal, and that was really fun. But then when I did Siegfried and Roy show, I worked my way to the top. There was already a designer, but we would put something new in the show, and I would sit down with Siegfried and we would light it. And lighting magic is unbelievably hard, you know, because you have to light it from every angle. And I learned a lot, but lighting that show was actually bragging rights, I guess. Cause if I could say Siegfried and Roy to pretty much anybody in our age range, and they would know that, and they're pretty intense. So they would know that's a big deal. Yeah. I mean, we had $100 million show, and I was early 20s running that, and it was intense. That was, now there goes back to when you say pressure. That's where my life pressure came from, is if you messed up a show, it's $250,000 at the door in revenue. So that was a show. And then I got the opportunity to run with Cirque du Soleil when we opened.
Yeah.
Oh, and built that show. And it was pretty freaking awesome. We would scuba dive with lighting and underwater. Yeah, and wow, just really, the people that you work with are pros. And so I've had a really bitching career, you know, so it's not, you don't ever see me wearing a lighting shirt. I'm always a BMX shirt guy, if you know, the stripes and lighting have been very good to me for 40 years. So it's a good time.
being a lighting expert, do you have to have an eye for it?
Yes. The thinking from what the act is and their perspective.
Yeah.
You know how it is being on stage is you turn on a light and all of a sudden people go like this, hey, that's too bright.
Yep.
And you're saying, oh, we're trying to make you look good. And if you understand the actor's point of view, because I always understood what my dad needed.
Yeah.
And we would run spotlight shows with my dad's show. And you had to make direct input on direction for solos, you know, drums, horns, you know, piano, banjo, you know, back to the star.
Yeah.
So I completely understood the system and I fit in really well, and I don't rock the boat while we're learning. You know, I don't, if there's a designer, they're paid to be there. I execute what they want. Then I massage it as when they turn the show over to us and the needs. So I, you know, you don't need somebody coming in trying to, I call it Groundhog Day, where you just need to, with these acts, they're expecting to see fly through the air. And if you have a light in their eyes on a certain point, you could harm them. Yeah. So the Cirque thing went, I mean, working for Siegfried Roy was amazing. We did Vegas Vacation and we did some movie stuff, and that was an opportunity. But then Cirque du Soleil was, wow, talk about up in the game. That was pretty bitching.
From the shows when you started to right now, what's the biggest difference do you see?
That's a really good question, because people used to go to shows because of the art of the talent.
Yes.
And some industries got so big that they would just have a machine on stage. Like if you went and saw Ka, it's a great, great individual artist, but the show is actually the set, you know, the set, the pieces that are moving in it. It's in awe seeing it, but it's become more mechanical, detached.
Yeah.
Like I went and saw U2 at the Sphere and just a couple of weeks ago. And it was a nice, you know, I've seen up to U2 up close, but seeing him in that venue, it was, they were just part of the experience.
Yeah.
So the dome and the whole atmosphere, like they're getting away from the single multi-talented person coming up. So I think all that grooming that we had for entertainment and show business is lost. Yeah. Because you don't go, hey, that person's a great singer. They'll grab somebody at 12 and say, well, how much soda can they sell? You know, it's maybe not as personal as it used to be, but definitely the change is it's gone so mechanical.
Yeah.
That the show is almost like you can plug and play actors in it, as opposed to having like a Danny Gans or Frank Sinatra or a Lou Rawls, or somebody that's just, you just go to see their talent and then everything else is just extra.
Wow. I'm really disappointed, first of all, that you did not invite me to go see you two. Okay. I would have flown down for that one. But you actually have met Bono.
Yes. Yes. I have his autograph right over here. They were trying to get backstage. They were here filming that famous video. Still haven't found what I'm looking for. Going down Fremont Street.
Yeah. Walking to the car.
So they were there that weekend. And I went to go backstage. And I saw Bono and Edge, because I was the youngest guy on the crew, trying to get backstage. So I got their production manager together with Sinatra. And then they brought him backstage. Wow. And then we all, after Sinatra did all his meet and greets, he came to the band room with us, and now we're all hanging out. So I got both their autographs, and then they invited us to their show, which was Thomas and Mac. And then we went, and they said, last night I saw the greatest singer of all time, and everybody's going, and they go, he goes, Frank Sinatra, and people are going, huh? They're all 20,
what?
You know, 20-year-olds in the audience going, what? Okay, because he's such a crooner. So yeah, been able to listen to their stories and watch their interactions. I always say, I'm really, really blessed with being that guy that's in the room. Like X Games in that era, I'm not the guy, but I, as every racer on here will say, is, man, just dream of rolling in and doing a trick or doing something cool in front of an audience like that, or a television audience. You know, that whole era was off the hook with the X Games and seeing what BMX had become too. So,
well, you were a team manager for Specialized. You talk to me, because it seemed like you were a little bit of out of BMX, but then you came back in. How was that? How did you get back in? And in the sense of being a team manager,
the easy friendships. I came out and was racing at Ed Fountain Park. I was an older guy just doing gate starts like Wednesday night, you know, Levi's in a t-shirt. Tommy Bracken sent me a bike, and I just felt like going out to the track. I go, what haven't I done that? Because you never quit loving BMX.
That's right.
You know,
that's
you true. Just don't, it's just, nope. You know, you just love. So I was doing gate starts and I see this kid just killing it, doing tricks. And I go, what? That's what we all aspire to. It was like doing 360s. We just crash our brains out. These guys are doing 360s in a moto, you know, and Landon. So it turned out to be TJ Lavin at like 15. So really? We became fast friends. And so we started hanging out and I started racing again because of him. So we would go to backyard tracks, Nick Herta, rest his soul. We ended up being good friends. And cause I loved how these guys are jumping. It's like exactly how I wished we could have had, is like, you know, Woodward and landing, you know, soft landing spots. And,
yeah.
And, we ended up doing things together. And then he got so big time, helped him with things along the way. And he's such a good human that he said, hey, what'll it take for you to be my team manager? And I said, well, here's my bills. I would do anything. I need insurance. That was it. And here's my bills. If I cover my bills, I would love to go out and be on tour. And I quit like the best job in the business. I was at O, assistant head of lighting at O for Cirque du Soleil. And I went and I said, okay, bye guys. I'm going to half my salary and go and bring tires and pumps to the X Games, you know, and then did 4 years with them. So I'm forever grateful that it was absolutely 100% TJ and Travis Chipper's.
Yeah.
Negotiated the deal because he was the manager at the time. So I got to go to every sort of relive my childhood, because standing on a roll-in with these guys in the X Games era was amazing. Huge talent. Some of these guys are just amazing. So that was how that came along. And then I became, you know, they hired me as their team manager. So I did the office stuff too, but I got to travel around and it was definitely worth doing.
Tell me this, you ended up racing Vet Pro for a bit, didn't you?
Yeah.
How did you get into that? And I mean, you racing against guys you raced against a while back, didn't you? Patterson?
Yes. Yeah. Patterson and Richie was doing it. And Harry, Larry and Eric Roop were really fast still. But I got to jump in on that because I met TJ, I got a bike with Tommy and started riding around and going to races, and then signed up for Vet Pro because I was in my 30s and you know, did okay. And it was a fabulous bookend for BMX because I don't have any regrets. Like I got to be there at the start and I got to be there in the middle, and I'm still there at the end. And it's been a good ride. It's been a good, great ride.
Tracer, do you think that you got everything out of your talent you could?
Boy, that's a good, I would say no. I think because era-wise, I probably could have been a faster amateur, you know, where if I trained really hard.
Yeah.
It was a hobby to me. We all leave things on the table, but how it turned out for me, no regrets. Could have trained harder, yes, or train. And but for me, my passion was jumping, and there wasn't a platform for it at that time. You know, that was something where, but I stand, like I said, standing on the roll-in, I felt complete because I saw what kids were doing, and always let them know how lucky they are that they got to do that. Okay. I wish that was around in our era.
This may sound like a weird question, but I've got to ask you, knowing, do you feel that you were freestyle before it was freestyle? And do you think that you were born in the wrong era?
I'm going to say no, because I've been able to go to some of these facilities, and I think my part, if I did have a part, I mean, I'm assuming, like when I talk to Connor or even TJ, is that you sort of pave the way for people, you know, like not being scared to crash my brains out, was probably a good push for what people were doing at the time. Like, guys get as high as I ever did, they'll do two flips and land it. You know, I mean, you sort of have to see what the future is before you can go and get it. And I don't know, I'm pretty proud that I did get a little bit of taste of that stuff. And, you know, I'm a pretty complete guy. I'm pretty satisfied.
Yeah.
So I would say I'm absolutely satisfied. Born in the wrong era? No, because that I'm not as technical as the guys would be, but I certainly had the drive to push it. You know, that's for sure.
Yeah. What's the best advice you've gotten in life? And I don't mean any, it doesn't have to be from BMX. It could just be from anyone in general. What's the best advice you've gotten? And we'll go from there.
You know, I guess the only thing I can really say that was my experience is my first tour on CW. I was sort of a young kid, way from, you know, bouncing around. Is I read a book called The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale. Yes. And I just felt like, and I underlined things. I remember with a pen, and I found that same book 20, 25 years later when I was moving. And I looked back and I felt like I lived a lot of my life based on that. Wow. And I went, you know, it became, when I read a sentence, I'd just say, of course, that's how you, don't complain, suck it up, you know, of course, you know, go the extra mile, show up early, work late, you know, it just, that to me, I guess, is the only thing that really holds water. Everything else has been pretty positive. And the gratitude for my friendships have been, don't ever take that for granted. All the guys you meet racing and girls are friends that'll carry you through life. Some of my best phone calls that I have are friends just shooting me a text telling me that they appreciate me. You know, and how you doing? And those are, they're pretty, I don't want to say pretty famous guys, but in their era, they were definitely kingpins, and they still take interest in how your day went. So the gratitude of friendships that you made in racing, don't ever just cut it off. You know, that's been the best string that I've had through my whole life is enjoying those relationships.
I'm curious, what are your thoughts on the racing now?
Oh, that's a really good, I thought you, because I look back at some of the cats you've had on it, and I would say if I was racing now, I would do everything these guys are doing to go fast. I think the drag is that it takes a little bit of the local, you know, I grew up with local heroes that helped shovel dirt and throw tires and work the snack bar, or, you know, that part of it, the families and the traveling. I like it. I like where it's gone. I'm a flat turn, feet out, frog town, dirty fest kind of guy. But that doesn't mean that this era isn't off the hook. You know, I mean, just think if you had the opportunity to go out and race the Olympics.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have sold my brother to see the success that like Connor has and what a great man he is for our sport and representative.
Yeah, for sure.
Luckily I'm around it. You know, I've seen him since he was a little kid and yeah. I've seen that progression and I've had interest in it because I always followed him. Our families are friends. I'm friends with his mom and his dad. And I'm okay with it because I know how hard they work to get there. You know, that you can't just fake it. It's pretty gnarly too. You can't just grab a bike and pedal to that first jump and think you're going to jump a 30-foot gap with slurry. You're casing hard and you're going to the hospital. So
I like it. Well, Tracer Finn, I want to say thank you so much for coming on the Lane 8 BMX podcast. It has been a lot of fun to talk to you, especially since as a kid, I would see you in the magazines and I would see all the pictures. And to finally, it's kind of surreal for me to sit here
to talk to you
on Zoom. So thank you for coming on.
Oh, man, appreciate it. And good luck to everybody that listens. And man, this BMX stuff, believe me, it's never ending. Don't ever drop it.
It's true.
Thanks, Todd.
You got it.